Just came. That's so good.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, recording is in progress. Hello, everybody. Sorry that we were a little late. There's just so much going on right now.
Yeah. Okay, so welcome to this 57th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages. People can also watch the recording if, there are those like Maria and Aunt Veronica. So that'll be available too. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the home page of moriafederation.com. And I did notice that today's webinar was listed up there in this upper left-hand corner. Okay, last time we took a look at the subsection called The Sun in Alchemical Symbology, where we learned that gold represents the perfection of matter, the highest state of transformation, and is thus the ultimate goal of the alchemist. A similar level of achievement is represented by the diamond, on which DK says, "The shining forth of the higher self through the medium of the lower self produces the revelation of the divine or spiritual self. The matrix holds the diamond, and when the matrix reveals its hidden gem and the work of cutting and polishing is accomplished, the glory of the jewel will be seen." Another Eastern school metaphor for hidden wisdom is the pearl, which MPH tells us is termed by the initiates the pearl of great price. In esoteric Hinduism, the blue pearl, or bindu, here held by Kuan Yin, is a symbol of inner vision. In alchemy, seeds of gold are considered to be the sparks. Notice how all of this is mineral plane metaphors. Seeds of gold are considered to be the sparks of life at the core of all sentient beings. But in order to flower, these seeds must be placed within the appropriate form. As suggested by the Rosicrucian axiom, a seed is useless and impotent unless it is put in its appropriate matrix. That also brings to mind the Bible words about where you cast your seeds, right? If you cast them on rocky ground, nothing grows. That would be an inappropriate form. We then took a look at Franz Hartmann's In the Pronaeus of the Temple, where we learned that the one from which all things are produced is perfect, and therefore all things contain within themselves the tendency and possibility for perfection. Next, a key alchemical statement, quote, "The purpose of alchemy was not to make something out of nothing, but rather to fertilize and nurture the seed which was already present. Its processes did not actually create gold, but rather made the ever-present seed of gold grow and flourish." I really like this quote. It shows that it's the entire alchemical process is a metaphor for becoming one with the soul. We then started a new section called The Midnight Sun, where we were introduced to an alchemical symbol called the green lion devouring the sun. The lion here represents the raw and powerful forces of nature, the prima materia that contains the seed of gold. It also symbolizes the corrosive action of the aqua regia, the royal water, which is a mixture of nitric and hydrochloric acid that can dissolve gold. The lion's devouring action represents dissolution and reduction of gold to its essence. So this is the outer physical sun, and the idea is that it's reduced to its essence so that the heart of the sun can come forth. The subjective sun holds the mystery of polarity, symbolized by the visible and midnight or dark suns. In alchemy, the dark sun or Sol Niger represents the nigredo stage, a phase of decomposition during which the alchemist's material, and metaphorically the alchemist's self, is broken down. The subjective sun was known in ancient Egypt and can be found in stories about Ra, who is depicted as a self-generated being emerging from the primordial waters of Nun. We then took a look at I Am the Man, who is the narrator and protagonist of the novel Edda Dorfa, a Masonic allegory and science fiction story by John Uri Lloyd. In this allegory, I Am the Man is given the secrets of nature and the soul of nature and the soul by Edda Dorfa, the heroine of the story, whose name is Aphrodite, spelled backwards. Next, we took a look at Typhon, then shapeshifting and lycanthropy, and the dual meaning of the serpent. And this took us to the last subsection of this chapter entitled Solar Colors, where MPH puts forward the idea that, contrary to the assertions made by modern physics, there are actually seven, not just three, primary colors, an idea also put forth by Plato and supported by the doctrines of the seven rays. DK says in Letters of Occult Meditation, well, actually, let's get a reader for this. I've been talking long enough. Can we get a reader, okay, please?
Yes. Colors as manifested on the physical plane show at their crudest and harshest. Even the most exquisite of shades is seen by the physical eye as hard and harsh compared to those on the emotional plane. And as the finer matter of the other planes is contacted, the beauty, the softness, and the exquisite quality of the different hues grows with each transition. When the ultimate and synthetic color is reached, the beauty transcends all conception.
Thanks, PL. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll start this section by rereading the last half of this passage, which is at the beginning of this new subsection, Solar Colors. Can we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that, please?
Sure. Consciousness, intelligence, and force are fittingly symbolized by the colors blue, yellow, and red. The therapeutic effects of the colors, moreover, are in harmony with this concept, for blue is a fine, soothing, electrical color, yellow, a vitalizing and refining color, and red, an agitating and heat-giving color. It has also been demonstrated that minerals and plants affect the human constitution according to their colors. Thus, a yellow flower generally yields a medicine that affects the constitution in a manner similar to yellow light or the musical tone mi. An orange flower will influence in a manner similar to orange light, and being one of the so-called secondary colors, corresponds either to the tone re or to the chord of do and mi.
Thank you, Iman. Okay, first up, consciousness, intelligence, and force are fittingly symbolized by the colors blue, yellow, and red. This is in line with theosophical teachings. Consciousness is the fundamental quality of the second aspect, of which blue is a representation. Both blue and indigo can represent the second ray. Force, which can be interpreted to mean will or power, is associated with the color red. No, you could also look at this as a seventh plane type of force demonstrating on the physical plane, and there is a red that corresponds with that as well, the red of materiality. And fourth ray yellow, color of Buddhi, is one of the colors of the intellect, along with the green of intelligent activity and the orange of the manasic plane. Next, the therapeutic effect. By the way, anytime you have any comments or questions, please jump in. As I've said many times, this is always, always more interesting as a conversation than as a lecture. So the therapeutic effect of the colors, moreover, are in harmony with this concept. For blue is a fine, soothing, electrical color. Yellow, a vitalizing and refining color, and red, an agitating and heat-giving color. So he's here referring to the physical plane level of red. True, all this is true, but this is only the effect of these colors on the physical plane. Let's take a look at a few statements from DK on the true nature of these colors. First, on indigo. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Trudy, can you read that for us, please? Well, I don't see her unmuting. Tom, can you read that for us, please? Okay, Scott.
The true indigo is the color of the blue vault of heaven on a moonless night. It is the culmination and at the attainment by all of synthesis. The solar night will supervene. Hence, the color corresponds to what the sky nightly proclaims. Indigo absorbs.
Thank you, Scott. So, blue and indigo are usually, though not always, interchangeable. DK tells us that blue is the color of the auric egg and the color of perfected man. Also that one of the names of the solar logos is the blue logos. So all these connect at least this form of blue to indigo. Blue is also one of the colors of the sixth ray, an electric blue is described at that. Just point out here that, you know, in this description of indigo as being the color of the night sky on a starless night, if you pointed a spectrometer to the night sky on a starless night, it's going to be black, right? It's not going to register as blue. So he's already indicating that this is an esoteric recognition of the actual color of the starless night. Black tends to indicate the void, the opposite of light, darkness in the three worlds, as opposed to the higher darkness, whereas indigo in this case represents really the source of deity in our solar system. I saw it. Ariane, you have a question?
I have a comment. I hope you're not too tired to take it, but at any rate, I will make a couple comments about blue and indigo. I think that it's important to think about the different hues, shades and intensities of blue. And so the throat chakras are paler blue, and the higher chakras are the blue-black. And when they show Krishna, Krishna was supposedly overshadowed by Maitreya, as Jesus was during his last 3 years. And the word Christ, Krishna, means black. And his face is normally portrayed as blue or bluish black. And when we think of dark matter, we know that dark matter is now the living substance of God, or the gods that make up our universe. And so when we as humans, I think, feel the terror of like the starry sky, the terror of night, the terror of darkness, it's partially because we're in, you know, experiencing on some emotional level the grandeur of that dark matter, that darkness. Mm-hmm. And I think Krishna's showing, you know, in his life, all the different stages of what it means to be a human being, both male and female, you know, so that one has a very personal idea of what it means to live fully and have also a God imbued life, that he's also, you know, through the color of his skin, he's reminding us that there's something else behind all of this as well. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, well, some really good comments about that. Of course, we don't have dark matter being the substance of the body of the gods as a teaching coming from DK, because dark matter at that time in history had not yet been hypothesized. You know, it's never actually been measured. It's only its effect that's been measured. Some people don't buy it. They think there are other laws in play that are creating what the effects that are attributed to dark matter. I'm no astronomer or physicist, but I have read that to be the case. But it is an interesting hypothesis. You know, and if it does exist, it is a kind of antimatter quality, which would seem to suggest, just as blue does, because, you know, blue is also the color that people turn at death. They gain a bluish hue. And I think that's also one of the reasons that blue is chosen to depict beings beyond the physical realm. Oh, yeah. Also, it's interesting to me that blood is blue. It only becomes red when it's exposed to oxygen, but as it passes through our veins and arteries, it's actually blue. It's I think quite esoteric reality. Anyone else? Any other thoughts?
Yes, Magda says the dark is also the skin color of the Madonnas around the world.
Right.
Marys, Magdalens, Miriam statues.
Yeah, and you know, we could say, you know, posit that what we're really looking at is, you know, there's two ways that it's the black, quote unquote, of the absolute, you know, the absolute darkness. And also a form of indigo, because it is the second principle, and the Madonna is fully and totally identified with the Christ within. You know, this is the Virgo par excellence. So you could say that her form literally represents the spirit aspect through that dark face. Yeah, it's a really interesting phenomena, this the Black Virgins. Anyone else? Okay. Hang on a second, I'm just catching my place. So let's read this passage on the color yellow. You know, he presented us with three colors up here in this blue, yellow, and red. And so we're following up on that. So could we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yellow is another of the colors that have come to us from System 1. The blending of blue and of yellow in that system had much to do with the production of activity. Yellow harmonizes, it marks completion and fruition. Note how in autumn, when the processes of nature have run their courses and the cycle is complete, the yellow of autumn is spread upon the landscape. Note also that when the sun pours unimpeded down the yellow of the harvest is also to be seen. So it is in the life of the spirit. When the fourth plane of harmony or of Bodhi is achieved, then is consummation. When the work of the personality is completed, and when the sun of the microcosm, the ego, pours unimpeded down into the personal life, then comes fruition and harvest.
Thank you. Just a second. One second. Okay, so thoughts or questions about this passage? Okay, and finally, on the color red, can we get a reader, please?
Marianne, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Let me just see if I can pull it up. Yes, thank you. Red is for all apparent purposes one of the most difficult colors to consider. It ranks as undesirable. Why? Because it has been considered as the color of kama, or evil desire, and the picture of the dark and lurid reds in the emotional body of the undeveloped man rises ever to one's vision. Yet, at some distant time, red will be the basis of a solar system. And in the perfect merging of red, green, and blue, will come eventually the completed work of the Logos and the consummation of the pure white light. The activity system was green. The love system is blue. The power system will be red. The result of merging red, blue, and green is, as you know, white. And the logos will then have esoterically washed his robes and made them white in the blood. Just as the microcosm, in a lesser sense, does in process of evolution. I would point out here that as you return to the center of systemic evolution, the nomenclature of these colors is most misleading. The red, for instance, has no resemblance to that termed red or rose on the lower plane. The red, the green, and the indigo of these higher levels are to all intents and purposes new colors of a beauty and translucence inconceivable. If justly interpreted, you have here a hint of the correspondence between the microcosm and the macrocosm.
Thank you. It's from that fantastic chapter in Letters of Occult Meditation on color. So yeah, this is one of the reasons I've never used red in my art, is because the red that you would love to use is the red of spirit, but that red doesn't show up on the physical plane, certainly not in pigments. So it's always very difficult. I spent some time finding this background to try to get some sense of the of a red that is not absolutely physical astral plane red, but it's a difficult color to work with. Unless, of course, you're working with the physical plane concepts, and in nature, in still life, and it's, you know, it can be a terrific color to use. But I find it quite challenging to use it in spiritual work. Okay, any thoughts or questions about these colors? I wanted to insert DK's take on these, because MPH, even though he's a student of esotericism, doesn't have that depth of understanding that DK does. All right, next up. It has also been demonstrated that minerals and plants, affect the human constitution according to their colors. Thus, a yellow flower generally yields a medicine that affects the constitution in a manner similar to yellow light or the musical tone mi. Both chamomile and dandelions are known for their calming and anti-inflammatory properties. The field of study, wherein an emphasis on color that DK here puts forth, is called color therapy, and is based on the concept that colors have specific energies that can have a tonic effect on our minds, emotions, and physical bodies. In color therapy, the color yellow is used to energize and stimulate all three bodies. It can, for instance, stimulate inspiration, sharpen our mental focus, help relieve depression, as well as strengthen the nervous system. For theosophists, a consideration of any color must also include their associations with the rays, the planes, and the planets. Yellow is the color of the fourth ray and of Mercury, messenger of the gods. And on the wings of this color streams the enlightened impressions of the intuition. At least once you work your way into a place where you can be impressed by the Buddhic plane, then this is the effect of yellow. Next, an orange flower will influence in a manner similar to orange light, and being one of the so-called secondary colors, corresponds either to the tone re or to the chord of do and mi. Both the blossoms from orange trees and marigolds have many healing properties. In color therapy, orange is used to increase one's appetite, boost self-confidence and optimism, improve one's mood and happiness, as well as heal the lungs and the digestive system. There's an amazing statement in Esoteric Healing on orange. Quote, when more anent color is known, only orange lights will be permitted in the sick room of a dying person. And these will only be installed with due ceremony when there is assuredly no possibility of recovery. Orange aids the focusing in the head, just as red stimulates the solar plexus and green has a definite effect upon the heart and life streams. A lot of precious information right there. In this last paragraph, MPH ties color to sound, which is also one of the tenets of theosophy. DK says, it is a truism to say that sound is color and color is sound. Yet, so it is. And the topic I really seek to bring to your attention is not so much sound as sound, but the color effects of sound. So what he really seeks to bring to our attention is not so much sound as sound, but the color effects of sound. DK then develops this theme in the next several pages of Letters of Occult Meditation. Right? When I was developing these papers on the colors of the egoic petals, these words came to mind that, you know, these petals are given different colors. You know, the lowest tier of petals has three colors, the middle tier has four, and the upper tier has five colors for each of the petals. And you know that you're looking at a three-note chord, a four-note chord, and a five-note chord when you're when you come into clairaudient contact with the energy of these petals. Yes, Ariane?
I have some thoughts just about red and the third chakra and the fact that we're moving from the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius. Can I just make a few of those comments?
Absolutely.
Just that when you think of the third chakra and that most of humanity is centered there, we're centered there, astrally polarized. And when he says it's associated with red or desire on a lower level, at our level, and we can't even see the higher colors. When I think about the lessons of the age of Pisces, in which, you know, the epitome is the crucifixion of Jesus on the cross. And mm-hmm. he, you know, so we think of red as, you know, the exposed blood and trauma and the experience of life. And when we consider just psychologically what has happened over the last 2100 years is that humanity became unique individuals through this experience of emotion. And what is emotion? Emotion is, I like this, I don't like this. This is a signifier for me. I don't, a directive for me to feel something so that I could understand my uniqueness, what my likes and dislikes are. But the shadow side of that is that when one pursues one's desires without an understanding of the impact one has in those pursuits, the impact on others, you know, those people whom one is born with, or the community that one finds oneself in, or one's partnerships, whatever that is, children, students, all those people, or someone at the grocery store, that when one is pursuing desires blindly without consciousness, then there will be trauma of all kinds. And as one becomes more evolved, the experience and understanding of what is violence or aggression or coarse, merely something that is coarse, is much more refined. It becomes much more subtle. And so when we think about this transition from Pisces to Aquarius, when we think about the crucifixion, we see Jesus play that role of the so-called victim on the cross, feeling physical pain, although he was three quarters light by that time because he was on the cross, a third and fourth degree initiate. He was making that transition through the experience of renunciation. So he's the victim, but he also is the witness. You know, he's the witness looking down on himself and on the crowd, and he's in direct experience with God, and he's also the perpetrator because This is a dramatic enactment that has touched everyone in humanity. So people don't know what the meaning is behind the crucifix, but they see it in almost every church. There will be a large altar with a crucifix, and it's a traumatic image. And yet esoterically, we know that it's a very special symbol of vertically the descent of consciousness into matter, and horizontally the possibility that we could pursue consciousness over time in the world of illusory time. Obviously, you know, we're just here in the blink of an eye and it's an illusion, but we have to take responsibility for that moment-to-moment possibility that we could be conscious. And that means that we understand that we've played those three roles, and we choose to increasingly play the role of the witness. And as we move into Aquarius, and, you know, Maitreya says he's here to teach the art of self-realization. He says, I am not as a teacher of old. I am not here to form any new religion. But what we're here to do is to bring consciousness through ourselves as unique individuals, but within a group. So because the collective and the issues at hand now are so large that we need to understand what is ours to do in relationship to the planet. And the planet is not really, unless one is already a high initiate, one, which some people are, maybe some people are in this room, I don't know, but that we have to come together and learn to cooperate, which is very different from the competition and the pursuit of desire that typifies Pisces, in which, you know, the narcissism during this transitional age, this transitional time, can be is something to behold.
Some great thoughts there, Magda. All right. Appreciate it. Yeah. DK tells us that red, that lower red, the red that we commonly see, is, you know, a color associated with the solar plexus, which acts as the portal to the astral. So it's, you know, hence you have things like the red light district, where the idea is to stimulate your sacral center, right? And really align with this, that level of vibration, which is literally being put forward by that color red, you know. And then of course he also tells us that there's this red beyond anything we know here now. But you had some great ideas. I can't go back through them all, but I appreciate your ideas. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, let me. Find our spot here. So could we get a reader for this next section?
Yes. And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Solar colors. The ancients conceived the spirit of man to correspond with the color blue, the mind with yellow, and the body with red. Heaven is therefore blue, earth yellow, and hell or the underworld red. The fiery condition of the inferno merely symbolizes the nature of the sphere or plane of force of which it is composed. In the Greek mysteries, the irrational sphere was always considered as red, for it represented the condition in which the consciousness is enslaved by the lust and passion of the lower nature. In India, certain of the gods, usually attributes of Vishnu, are depicted with blue skin to signify their divine and supermundane constitution. According to esoteric philosophy, blue is the true and sacred color of the sun. The apparent orange-yellow shade of this orb is the result of its rays being immersed in the substance of the illusionary world.
Thank you. Okay, so first, glad you made it on, Aunt Veronica.
I lost the beginning, but I had some work to do, but I came in.
Well, you know, we didn't start till about 10 after because we were waiting for people to show up. So you may not have lost as much as you think. Anyway, there will be a recording.
Okay.
Okay, first up, the ancients conceived the spirit of man to correspond with the color blue, the mind with yellow, and the body with red. Heaven is therefore blue, earth yellow, and hell, or the underworld, red. In ancient Egypt, the soul of a person called the Ba had blue feathers and hair, and the sun god Ra had a blue face and a brown crown, a blue crown, blue face, blue crown. In Hinduism, as was mentioned, I don't know if it was Arian or Magda, in Hinduism, Krishna, in fact, all the gods are often depicted with blue skin, suggesting in Krishna's case that he is a manifestation of the cosmic ocean. In Greece, yellow was associated with intellect and enlightenment, and thus with Apollo. In China, yellow represented the cultivation of wisdom and morality, and was associated with the Yellow Emperor, who was the legendary ancestor of the Chinese people. Red has a double, and in some cultures, even a triple meaning. For example, in Egypt, red was the color of bodily vitality and was used to ward off evil and disease. It was also the color that represented victory and the power of the pharaoh, thus associating it with the first ray. Finally, it was the color of the god Set, who represented chaos, violence, and the desert, and in this way was similar to the Greek god of war, Ares. In ancient China, red was the color of fire, energy, and happiness. It was also the color of the dragon, which was the symbol of the emperor and the cosmic order, again, tying it to the first ray. Next up, the fiery condition of the inferno merely symbolizes the nature of the sphere or plane of force of which it is composed. In the Greek mysteries, the irrational sphere, and that would be a higher sphere, beyond ration, was always considered as red, for it represented that condition in which the consciousness is enslaved by the lusts and passions. Oh, then this is not what they mean by the irrational sphere. Okay, scratch my comments there. This would be, this would place the rational sphere at the level of Buddhi and the irrational spheres as the three lower kingdoms of humankind, in which the consciousness is enslaved by the lusts and passions of the lower nature. So Plato divided the soul into three parts, the rational, the spirited, and the appetitive or irrational. In the Republic, he compares the soul to a chariot with two horses and a charioteer. The charioteer represents the rational part, while the horses represent the spirited and the appetitive part. The charioteer's task is to control the horses and guide them towards the good and the beautiful. However, the horses are often unruly and pull the chariot in different directions. The white horse represents the spiritual part, which is noble and obedient, but sometimes gets carried away by pride and ambition. The black horse represents the appetitive part, which is base and stubborn and always lusts for sensual pleasures and material goods. I think it's a great metaphor. But even more poignantly descriptive of the irrational sphere is Plato's allegory of the cave. This story, also from the Republic, describes a group of prisoners who have been chained inside a dark cave since their birth and can only see the shadows of objects projected on the wall by a fire behind them. They believe that these shadows are the true reality and have no idea of the outside world. One day, one of the prisoners escapes and sees the real objects and the sun, which represent the higher forms of being and the source of truth. He returns to the cave to free his fellow prisoners, but they reject his message and think he is crazy. Finally, in India, certain of the gods, usually attributes of Vishnu, are depicted with blue skin to signify their divine and supermundane constitution. According to esoteric philosophy, blue is the true and sacred color of the sun. The apparent orange-yellow shade of the orb is the result of its rays being immersed in the substance of the illusory world. Called by Hindus the sustainer, Vishnu corresponds to the theosophical second logos and is thus of the Hindu Trimurti the most closely associated with our solar logos and this second ray solar system. Okay, thoughts or questions? Anybody?
Yes, we have several. Anne Veronica says Eris is Mars.
Right.
And then Trudy says Buddhists always wear red.
Yeah, they do.
And Aryan says the triangle, the victim, perpetrator, and witness, is what typifies potential roles each of us plays in the dramatic enactments of both the age of Pisces and, to a lesser extent, the age of Aquarius, during which we are outgrow the selfish, aggressive, if not violent, orientation of our own past, and many individuals at present whose orientation is centered in the third chakra, their own emotional development, their own uniqueness, and the refinement of desire.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I just did a presentation on the transition between the ages, and you know, what you say is exactly true, and it's according to DK's words as well, that there's going to be a fundamental energetic shift. That is literally the energy that impacts humanity is in a process of changing. And this new energy is already dissipating the Piscean vibration. And this is one of the reasons there's such alarm and there's such division, is because we really are in that place, that it's a very cusp-like place between the two ages. And so the most regressive qualities of the sixth ray, and which rule Pisces, which is now a waning in its cycle for some time now, actually, are coming forward, the most regressive aspects of this ray. And the results we see all over the place, we see in the world around us. Thank you for your comments.
And then Magda says the center, rational, yellow, Christic way guides the other two colors, the supermundane blue, the sun, and the mundane in red, inferior realm. It says correct?
Did it said guide it? Is that what she said?
Guide.
As in like a plant dye or something?
No. Starts with a G.
Oh, guide.
Guide.
Got
Oh
it.
yeah,
Right.
sure. It's
Yeah.
it's a color of mercury that gives you, and the fourth ray, which acts as the intermediary, right? So it's also the color of the Buddhic plane. So you have the blue monadic, this the sixth, the red as the astral sixth, and also just all the three lower planes. And then you have that guiding force. Literally, it is the force of Bodhi, which liberates one from the personality condition. Yeah, good thoughts. Anyone else?
No, that's all I see right now.
Okay.
Go ahead, Scott.
Going way back to the colors of our star in our its unfoldment through three different colors. I'm wondering if when we look out now and see red giants and red dwarfs, if they aren't in their third system too, or something like that, where most of the stars out there I think are yellow or yellow blue like ours. Now, what do you do with the green one? If you can go to green and orange, maybe there's a primary there that preceded this one. But the yellow and the blue and the red seem pretty manifest as we look out in the stars. And
They sure do. Indeed. So then, are we looking at kind of primordial red
well,
that suggests, huh?
they're considered dying stars, so
Yeah,
that would be.
exactly. Which, you're right. Yeah, just that phase of life certainly suggests the third solar system as opposed to the first, for instance. Of course, DK says that you can determine a color also by its opposite. And the opposite of red is green. So you could be looking at, but the fact of it's dying, but see, this could be the dying. I mean, these are just ideas popping. I don't pretend to know, but it could be the dying of the first solar system in a group of three, for instance, rather than the dying of the third solar system characterized by the first ray. It's either are possible. I don't have a sense of one being more likely than the other.
Except the red stars tend to be super giants. So there are
I
more.
do. And what does that mean? More material or
Right.
fully demonstrating themselves, you know?
Because if there are red dwarfs out there, and apparently there are, but they're so small and so dark that they can't be seen readily, can't by astronomers. So that's another deal. I don't know. Just thinking about the. These colors and their opposites, and the stars we see, and the
Yeah.
different.
And then you have the possibility that, we're seeing all of these stars because they manifest on the physical plane, right? And it's DK tells us that our next solar system won't be manifesting on this on the lower planes. The lowest level for the coming solar system will be the Buddhic plane. That will be the average, the incarnational plane, quote unquote, for humanity, right? So then one wonders, well, this type of solar system, which would be equivalent to our next solar system, wouldn't be visible, if that holds. It's just another idea about this.
Yeah, and if all of them can be measured by our development, I'm not sure that's so.
Exactly, or even, ours as a second ray solar system, what do first ray solar systems look like? They still have to go through their three stages or seven stages or who knows what to develop. And, I'm sure there are, lot of questions, not so many answers, but our solar system's always first, second, or third ray solar systems, no matter where they are in their development, you know, or are all seven rays represented by solar systems?
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, when they find a green star, that'll be something to pay attention to.
Yeah, exactly. Good thoughts, Scott, thanks.
Anyone and else? Veronica has put a bunch of pictures, well, two pictures in the chat box. If I don't know if you can look at them, they're colors relation to, yeah, it looks like maybe stars in relation to their temperatures in the active region.
It's the colors of the sun.
Our sun.
Yes, our sun. And it has the Armstrong. And it says, what filter they put, it's the color that you see. Because basically our sun is white. That's why I made a small search in the internet. All these are the colors you can see from the sun.
Really? Wow. So,
please put the other picture first up, because it has the Armstrong and you will see the blue. It has it also here, 335 Armstrong. So it has to do with the...
That's the only picture I'm... Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I see. Here we go. So you put up two pictures, right?
Yes.
Okay, hang on a sec. Oh, I bet it's in... Oops. All right, guys. All right. So my guess is if I resize this, it'll show up. No, it only grabbed this one. Hang on just a sec. Let me see if I can pick it off the chat. Okay. See, you guys don't see the chat when I do. So it says... Okay, it says I can download it. It's probably the best way to go.
Okay, never mind.
No, I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there we go. All right.
Look at that beautiful blue. 335 Armstrongs. This is our sun.
Okay, so let me get these resized, and then I'll give you the floor and you can describe what we're looking at. Here we go. All right, and play. Go ahead, Anne Veronica.
Well, there was a question, why are there so many different colors of our sun? And now there's somebody that answers, but we have to look more into it, because the picture is likely a very small subset of wavelengths and colorized to allow you to see it, so you can know at a glance what wavelength you're looking at. You'll find images in yellow, red, orange, purple, blue, green, cyan, and etc. But this is one post from a site. I don't know how true it is or it isn't, but I saw that they say that the true color of the sun is white. And so it has to do with Armstrongs. And you see the second picture, that beautiful blue is 335 Armstrongs.
Armstrongs. Okay, so what I heard you say, yeah, so these ones on the right are blow-ups of some of the ones here on the left.
Yes.
So what I'm hearing you say is that if you use a blue filter, that enables you to see certain aspects of the surface of the sun that you don't see using other color filters, which is different than saying it's literally blue, but nonetheless, it's interesting in that way. Am I right in that? For instance, if you just take this 304 angstrom here, and the surface features are very, that are revealed is very different than the surface features on, well, really either of these other two. But, and that this 304, for instance, was made possible by using this frequency of color.
Yes.
Is that correct?
As far as I can understand, I have to search more of it, because I went searching because I remembered that beautiful blue sun you had shown us in one webinar. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, and it would have been, that's interesting, because I now see it's not just somebody saying, oh, gee, let's make the sun blue, and they put a blue filter over it, which I could do in Photoshop. But you're actually seeing different aspect of the sun by photographing it through this blue filter. That's what I'm understanding.
At a certain wavelength. Now, the wavelength has to do with the color, too.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That's really interesting.
And okay. The beautiful green and the light green, the yellow, all of them are beautiful.
Yes, indeed. So then you wonder, you know, it just shows the relative nature of the, you know, of color. You know, all of these exist at the same time. All these features of the sun exist at the same time, which are optimized through these particular colors, filters or wavelength photography, I would guess, is something like that. Okay, let me go back.
It reminds me of what NASA does when their big telescopes out there take pictures of the planets and the stars out there. They use different filters and different wavelengths to determine the composition.
Right.
You know, what gases it's made up in and that kind of stuff. So
yeah, well, I think that's in a way what we're looking at here, you know.
Yeah. Well, here we're looking at different frequencies, but yeah. Magda says the higher the charge, the different and more splendid the tones to the sun.
Interesting. Okay.
Yvonne has her hand up. Go ahead, Yvonne.
These different colors, didn't you say that the first, second, and third solar system are going to have the red, blue, and the green? The first one was green. But if there are seven solar systems out there, they could be on the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh ray, and they could be have different colors suns.
Yeah, absolutely. It's possible. Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, but if you take the minor incarnation of this solar system, you get more than three. There's DK talks in TCF, he talks about minor solar incarnations that happen between these three major ones, of which we're in one. So who knows, maybe one of those is characterized by one of the rays of attribute. Anyone else?
Yes, Janet says, so our eyes will be changing in the next system?
Yeah, if you want to see anything. Yeah, I would think very much so. You know, it would be read, it'd be really interesting to read a description by DK of what human eye was like in the previous solar system. You know, it certainly wouldn't be, I mean, for instance, vision is considered the synthetic sense among the lower five anyway, you know, because all is coordinated through vision. But possibly in the previous solar system, it, well, first of all, it might not have existed at all. You know, it might have been just sound and touch or hearing and touch. I'm not saying it was, it's just that, and if it did exist, it would have been something quite different in terms of the impact that it had on your mind or brain consciousness. I saw Ariane's hand.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just have a couple comments. One is that, you know, when Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, he was describing the sky as red, you know, more than just the sunrise and sunset. And supposedly it's related to the fact that the cones and rods of the eye were not as developed at the time. So, yeah, humanity did not have, you know, Homer was blind, right? It's like the seers of old, like the seers in Oedipus, you know, people are blinded, Milton, to go inside. But the other thing I wanted to mention is about the etheric realm and etheric sight, which may relate to the dark matter comments that you made before. So I think DK talks about there's like four phases of matter beyond solid, liquid, and gas. And those are the four phases of etheric. And because we lack etheric sight, unless one's a clairvoyant, we can't see that the other planets are inhabited. And for any one of us here who's had the privilege and the pleasure to have met someone from another planet, as wild as that might seem to you, that I'm saying that, or to see a spaceship, or to see a scout ship, and to feel the love emanating from these beings for us, and how they have served us tirelessly for decades now, because one of their projects is to come in to our stratosphere and vacuum up the nuclear waste that's leaking from all the power plants, all the nuclear energy power plants are leaking. I'm not talking about the different kinds of nuclear energy. I'm talking about the present form of nuclear energy. We have not only the bombs, but the power plants, which are considered criminal entities and are not only contaminating all life, our longevity, our quality of life on this planet, including the life of animals and plants, but also endangering the planet itself and the other planets in the solar system. So this particular thing is making us into a rogue planet, and it needs to be addressed as soon as possible. And this is one of the roles of the Space Brothers. And without them, we would be already a dead planet.
Okay. Thank you, Ariane.
Okay, Francis?
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment here on the vision thing, because to me, it gets back to what we know from the constitution of man and the evolution of our senses. You know, sight on the physical etheric plane is sight as we know it, but on the astral plane, it's clairvoyance, and on the mental plane, it's higher clairvoyance, and then on the Buddhist plane, it's actually divine vision. So as we evolve, as we center ourselves more and more on those higher planes, all of our senses will change into something different than what we experience on the physical plane.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And actually, we keep our sense of sight, you know, as we gain etheric vision, and you know, we keep our outer sense of sight, and then we add to it that inner sense of clairvoyance. You know, and I would think any incarnated high initiate would use the appropriate version of whatever sense in order, you know, depending on what they are working with, you know. But I would also think that there's a simultaneity in them. My favorite line is taste, imagination, discrimination, and intuition, you know, and that the idea that in a sense they all happen simultaneously, you know, once you've reached the level of intuition, that is, right, then you're aware of the roots of, in your sense of taste, you're aware that the true root of your sense of taste is the intuition, you know, in a way that's quite difficult to decide or to define, you know, and that, you know, each of them are present and according to your development. Thanks, BL. Good stuff.
And That leads into what you said about in the next solar system, we're going to be starting out on the Buddhic plane.
Exactly.
So we're already there with those higher senses at that point.
Exactly. You know, you would be looking at intuition as being the fundamental sense of taste at that point. You know, I mean, it's
how right. Can you, I know. Yeah. Blows the mind, doesn't it? Okay, Magda says our seeing will be subtler, our touch lighter, our step quick and silent, our love spontaneous, our body beautiful, and the new earth perfect, easy, wise, and tasteful in every unity of time.
Very beautiful. And what I would say is all that's going to be true even in the sixth root rays, that we don't have to wait till, you know, we can't conceive of a next solar system, you know, but we can, just by what we're told of what will happen in our very next root race, which is just a few million years away, you know, what you said to me describes the way DK talks about that root race. And that's a teeny increment compared to even the next globe, let alone the next round, let alone, you know, the next cosmic cycle, which would be, you know, the next literal incarnation of the solar logos. So yeah, it's your imagination stops. You just can't really project beyond a certain stage, because your superlatives will actually be realized in a relatively short time when it comes to the unfoldment of the race, you know. And then beyond that, we just can't know. So, all good news, though. Anyone else? Okay, no. Let's finish this chapter. Can we get a reader?
Okay, who hasn't read? Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. In the original symbolism of the Christian church, colors were of first importance, and their use was regulated according to carefully prepared rules. Since the Middle Ages, however, the carelessness with which colors have been employed have resulted in the loss of their deep emblematic meanings. In its primary aspect, white or silver signified life, purity, innocence, joy, and light. Red, the suffering and the death of Christ and his saints, and also divine love, blood, and warfare or suffering. Blue, the heavenly sphere and the states of godliness and contemplation. Yellow or gold, glory, fruitfulness, and goodness. Green,
fecundity,
thank you. Youthfulness and prosperity. Violet, humility, deep affection, and sorrow. Black, death, destruction, and humiliation. In the early church art, the colors of robes and ornaments. I'm sorry, my brain sometimes, I know the word, but I can't say it. Also revealed whether a saint had been murdered, as well as the character of the work that he had done to deserve canonization.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to just add that I was also thinking of I don't know if others see colors when they're meditating, and meditation deep, I guess that's the way I express it after going through the Yoga Sutras. And then I think I thought you may have mentioned, you know, that once you go through maybe initiation, you start seeing different colors that are indicating that you have moved on. I don't know, maybe I misheard that wrong. I don't know.
No, I think that's right.
That's where I was kind of coming from.
Yeah, I think every plane, every subplane has a progressive quality of the colors that we see. And that they, you know, as D.K. described in that wonderful passage from Letters on a Call Meditation, that they become, you know, that even the most beautiful colors on the physical plane are just dead by comparison to those higher colors. And I'm sure that that's what you come into awareness of as, you know, through meditation and through walking the spiritual path. Okay, so first up, in the original symbolism of the Christian church, colors were of first importance, and their use was regulated according to carefully prepared rules. Since the Middle Ages, however, the carelessness with which colors have been employed has resulted in the loss of their deeper emblematic meaning. These were called liturgical colors. Pope Innocent III wrote a treatise called De Sacro Alteris Mysterio, in which he explained the meaning and the usage of the four main liturgical colors, white, red, black, and green. Next, in its primary aspect, white or silver signifies life, purity, joy, and light. Red, the suffering and death of Christ and his saints, and also divine love, blood, and warfare or suffering. Blue, the heavenly sphere, and the states of godliness and contemplation. Yellow or gold, glory, fruitfulness, and goodness. Green, fecundity, youthfulness, and prosperity. Violet, humility, deep affection, and sorrow. Black, death, destruction, and humiliation. So this stained glass window, which depicts the life of St. Francis of Assisi, gives examples of the liturgical colors mentioned. The reclining figure with the missing face is Mary, uniquely clothed in the green of fecundity and the violet of humility. St. Francis at right wears a gold cap representing glory and has a blue nimbus representing the heavenly sphere. Interestingly, these colors are reversed in the figure representing God in the center of the window. Finally, the Christ child is clothed in the white of purity, innocence, joy, and light. And then finally, we have in early church art, the colors of robes and ornaments are revealed whether a saint had been martyred. Oh, I'm sorry. So in early church art, the colors of robes and ornaments also revealed whether a saint had been martyred, as well as the character of the work that he or she had done to deserve canonization. So here's an image of the saints George, Catherine, Margaret, and Andre, in which we see all the liturgical colors represented. As an example, St. Catherine of Alexandria at left center wears the white cloak of virgin purity and holds the breaking wheel on which she was tortured. Okay, next up, the last short paragraph of this chapter on the sun. Can we get a reader, please?
I'll read that. In addition to the colors of the spectrum, there was a vast number of vibratory color waves, some too low, and others too high, to be registered by the human optical apparatus. It is appalling to contemplate man's colossal ignorance concerning these vistas of abstract space. As in the past, man explored unknown continents, so in the future, armed with curious implements fashioned for this purpose, he will explore these little-known fastnesses of light, color, sound, and consciousness.
Thanks, Bill. So NPH has commented is not so much about that which lies beyond infrared and ultraviolet color, but rather those colors found on the higher subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. DK says, it might here be asked why color primarily is spoken of as the Buddhic manifestation of electricity. We are employing the word color here in its original and basic sense as that which veils. Color veils the sevenfold differentiation of logoic manifestation and, from the angle of vision of man in the three worlds, can be seen only in its full significance on the Buddhic plane. One of those extraordinary quotes. I saw Ariane's hand. Yes, Ariane?
Right.
Yeah, I want to go back to the image of the saints, if that would be all right.
Sure.
Okay, so this reminds me of paintings in which you see the muses and the sibyls and such, where you have, in the Renaissance from Filippo Lippi and others. And so you see, they look very similar, but if you know the codes, you would be able to read them. But what I want to talk about is the wheel, because I think the wheel needs to be mentioned. So just a personal story. I knew a couple people who were in a car accident in Egypt, and I've been in a serious car accident. Egypt is very easy to do in the third world, where, you know, there's no laws about speeding and traffic and such. Right. And so the woman who was extremely joyful, she was killed, and her husband survived. And the last picture of them had one of these wheels by them, and it clarified for me that the wheel is just a symbol again of the wheel of karma, and that she had sort of gone beyond her own personal suffering. She was extremely joyful and independent of circumstances that were happening to her. And we see that in Buddhism also there's a use of the symbol of the wheel, in which so not to be lost in the projective aspects of life, that we're creating our own drama, our own video game, our own. And the wheel turns, because every moment we are thinking, feeling, acting in such a way that the wheel is spinning. We're creating more karma. And where is the karmic enactments recorded? It's actually, from my own understanding recently, and I tried sharing this with some people who were not open to it. Maybe you will be open to it. It's actually in light. That light is actually recording vibration, recording thought, and not just behavior, but thought and feeling. So light is impressed and is the place where all is changed. You can feel an environment if what has gone there. Is it been uplifted, like in a church or a Buddhist temple, or is it a place like where there was a crime? It's all there in an environment, but it's recorded on the level of light. And then it descends into matter, because light is the other side of matter. And we know that in terms of some, this in-between state of water, you know, when you see Masaru Emoto's photographs of water, the Japanese, right. You know, civilian scientists who would, you know, take samples of water around different places. And
but he
did not account for, and I met him once, he did not consider his own projections and his own attitudes confounding his data. So there's incredible pictures of light, you know, different snowflake and crystalline patterns that appear in different places, or the lack thereof, depending on what kind of music or environment it is. But when he talked about taking pictures of water exposed to different words, he never excluded his own level of consciousness and his own beliefs and attitudes, his own emotions, that could have also clouded what he was doing. And in the future, science will always have to, it's not just the, I think it's called the Heisinger principle, one of those names, not quite sure, that when one is aware, the field of experience changes, what one observes is changing. And so science has yet to incorporate this fact, not only the expectations, you know, the double blind issues in afforded to scientific research, where they try to have a control group, which is, you know, offset what the hypothesis is that they're testing. But this other thing, which is not just the expectations of the researcher, the person holding the mice and all that, but or what they assume, like in the Zimbardo experiment, that, you know, people acting like prison guards are going to act a certain way, and the inmates, these Stanford students, are going to act a certain way, which beclouded that prison experiment in psychology and still not recognized, but that the level of consciousness of us as we live our lives and also of these researchers becloud science. And that's it.
Yeah, good points. I'm wanting to finish this chapter because we're just at the verge, and I'd like to start next month with it. So if you all can hang a few more minutes, we'll get back to this. Quick illustration at the center of the page here, right? Entitled The Solar Face, which comes from the book Montfaucon's Antiquities. He actually drew a lot from that book. Here's the original
image.
And Veronica, your mic is on. Can you mute her? Thank you. So here's the original image. You can see what a difference, huh? The caption states, "The corona of the sun is here shown in the form of a lion's mane. This is a subtle reminder of the fact that at one time the summer solstice took place in the sign of Leo, the celestial lion." That would have been, summer solstice would have regularly occurred in Leo during the age of Taurus, which took place between 4300 and 2150 BC, approximately, during which time the Mesopotamian sun god Shamash was often shown accompanied by one or more lions. And we also have this Greek sun god Apollo in a chariot drawn by a lion and a boar. The boar is associated with Scorpio, and thus this represents the two arms of the fixed cross. And that, my friends, finishes our analysis of the chapter, The Sun, a Universal Deity, which I think we've been on for many, many months. When we turn the page of the folio edition, we come to a new chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. And we'll start next time by analyzing the frontispiece, which depicts an outer tier of throned constellational lords and an inner group of 10 white-robed figures representing the three aspects of the sun and seven planets, all facing a flaming altar circumscribed by a golden triangle. So yeah, this is where we'll start next time. So thank you all for showing up. It was a small group today, but I think it worked, and people can always watch the recording if they missed out. So,
okay, dates.
Yes, dates.
Next up is the Treatise on Cosmic Fire on Friday, the 14th of June. Then will be the Secret Doctrine on Sunday, the 16th of June. And then will be the next Secret Teaching of All Ages on the 7th of July.
What about the second TCF?
Oh, yeah. What would that be, the 28th of June?
Fourth Sunday if you're looking at a calendar.
I'm not. Hold on.
That's all right. It doesn't matter.
Just, well, yeah, it's the fourth, one, two, yeah, 28th of June.
28th, that makes sense, yeah. So we go over these dates every time, so just remember that. We got a little bit of a break here until the first TCF on the, what was that date again?
14th.
14th, yeah. So we have almost a two-week break before the next webinar, just the way the time fell this time. So, okay, you all, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time around.
Thank you, BL and Francis, for your efforts on our behalf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.